Mayfly time is the pinnacle for most brown trout anglers, and we're pleased to announce our next Ireland on the Fly Masterclass is focusing on mayfly tactics with international angler, guide and renowned fly tyer Jackie Mahon.
On Thursday the 25th of April at 8 p.m, Jackie will be discussing how to make the most of the conditions, the best flies and methods to use, as well as giving his tips and insights from a lifetime of experience.
So, to join us for this masterclass on Thursday 25th of April, just go to www.irelandonthefly.com/masterclass. Tickets cost €10 and all attendees will get a copy of Jackie's notes as well as access to the recording of the webinar afterwards.
And stay tuned for our masterclasses throughout 2024, covering salmon, rivers, lochs, streamers, lures, dries, everything to make you a better salmon or trout fly angler, helping you to catch more this year and to learn from the best. For more information, email us on info@irelandonthefly.com.
Hello and welcome to the Ireland on the Fly podcast about the people and places of fly fishing in Ireland. We're into the last few weeks of the salmon and trout season now, and for this week's episode, we're joined by Peter Driver, founder of Piscari Fly in Kilkenny, and a highly accomplished trout angler who just recently captured the National Rivers Championship. Peter talks to us about the importance of mindset and mentality in enabling him to capture the national title, plus he talks tactics for September river fishing, and how the 2022 season was for him. So Tom, before we hear from Peter, I just thought there were some really interesting insights from him on how he approaches a river for his competition fishing. And I suppose it's something we can all learn a lot from.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear that, all right? I mean, particularly, you know, when he talks about thinking properly and, you know, how you could lose your mind, not lose your mind, but, you know, lose it. And do things wrong, basically, is what he was going on. One of the really interesting things I thought was how, with a limited amount of time yet, when he discusses it at one of the sessions in this year's championship, with a limited amount of time, he had to decide what to do. I think that's fascinating, rather than just, you know, all you're doing is you're chucking out a line and hope something's going to get with it. But no, I thought that was brilliant. And as he said, for that session, it turned out right for him with a very limited amount of time left. But as he said, you know, maybe other times it wouldn't have worked for him.
For me, what I thought was very interesting was when he talked about, because he won the competition on the Avonmore River. Basically, he said, like, he knew it, like, you know, he grew up on it. Like, and so my initial question was going to be to him, okay, well, surely that was a benefit and advantage and, you know, that helped. But he was actually saying, no, sometimes that actually goes against you because you go there with a preconceived kind of notion of this is the way this fish is.
Wasn't that really interesting?
Yeah.
And actually, as soon as he said that, it was like, you know, I hadn't put it that way in my mind, but it was exactly, you know, it was very clear in that way because, you know, I fish competitions as well. And sometimes when they're on my home waters here, you know, you can go in like that and I wouldn't try different things. And whatnot, and particularly so on a river, as he said, you know, when he'd know the beats, you know, whereas somebody that doesn't know it that well would come in with a completely different frame of mind and maybe do well in it.
For me, and it comes back to, I know we've covered this before in the podcast, it's like, I'm not a competition angler, I'm never going to be in a million years, but, and I'd say, you know, the vast majority of people listening to this probably aren't either, but you learn so much from it. That's what I love about it. When I listen to somebody like Peter talking about how they approach the river, how they approach the stretch of water, the mindset to it is, and like I said, we're not, you know, when I go fishing, I'm not going with the mindset of, oh, I have 3 hours, duh, 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 duh. But like, still, you're just picking up little nuggets all the time. So yeah, I found it fascinating. And then, you know, obviously, yeah, we get into kind of September tactics and, you know, as well, actually the fly tying that's going to be starting in October. So actually I want to ask you, Tom, how do you feel now? Because you've got, what are we now? Mid-September. You've about 2.5 weeks left before the end of the season. Are you like
17 days, 4 hours and 22 minutes, but so like really who's then counting? what do I have left? Was I right there when I said 17 days? No, it's actually 19 days.
Well, oh, no, it depends when this episode goes out.
Yeah, it does actually. Okay. When this episode goes out, it'd be about 14 days. All right. Yeah. Yeah. I get a bit, what's the word? Shifty. I feel, oh my God, I've got to maximize the time. But like, I'm really busy now, so I actually only have a couple of days left fishing for myself. I always tell you, I don't boat for the last 2 days of the season. So I've got
that's
them
your time. Board.
Yeah. They're my 2 days. I'll do a day on mask and a day on car probably. But yeah, let's say if I was just fishing for myself, and I know the feeling, and a lot of other guys will have it, oh my God, we're running out of time. I'm running out of time. Oh, I've got, and then, you know, you'll stay at the start of September. Well, do you know what? I'm going to fish Shetland now. I'll get up to Lean and I'll do mask. I'll get on to Arrow. And then half the month goes through and you realize you haven't achieved any of those trips. You're going, oh, right, okay. And you've loads of plans. And, you know, if 20% of them materialize, you're doing well.
Yeah. What is it they say? If you want to make God laugh, tell him you've got plans.
Yeah.
Tell me this. So, like, how has the fishing been? Like, you know, on Carrow in September?
Tough. Oh, it's really, really tough. It's not disastrous. Okay, that's what I'd say. But it was out today. I'll give you an example of today. We're out today. We rode 6 fish for the day. Okay, all day. It started off well, and it was cloudy. And for the first couple of drifts, we had the best action. We rode 3 fish, got one of them, it was about 1.5 pounds. Lost another guy that was well over 2 to 3 pounds. Between 2 and 3 pounds, I should say. Well over 2, probably not 3. And rose another one. And then sun came out. And as often the case in September, when you don't get good conditions in September, because you don't have a huge amount of fly, there's no reason for the fish to be looking up, you know?
Okay, so
I find that, you know, it's one of the things I find about September fishing. You really need the conditions going well. Anyway, so we didn't rise another fish till about, I think it was 3:30. And we rose 4 fish after 3:30. We got one of them. And he was fish between 13 and 14 inches and hit another one. So for the day, we 2 fish, lost one, and rose 4 others.
And traditionally, how would September, like if you look back on the diaries, like...
It always depends on conditions. But like you'd be looking for a livelier day of moving fish in the double figures, right? You know, that's what you want. I mean, you'll have some good days and you might boat 5, 6, 7, or 8 of them, really good days. And then other days you might only boat 1 or 2 of them, but you want the action. It's the action that keeps us going. It's like if you move a fish in a drift or see fish moving, it keeps you going. Like, I don't know, remember, because I listened to it recently, we were talking about, talked to you before about Kingsman Moore. And if you actually read a man-made fish, his best ever September day was only 9 trout.
And that was the best ever. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, he did put in the thing with it. Okay, they were always good fish. They were always around 2 pounds. But, you know, that was it. You know, so it's, you know, got to remember. But, like, to be honest, what you're looking for is action, right? And if you rise a dozen to 20 fish in a day, that's great. Or you could be really lucky and get 50% of them, maybe more. Then other days you won't. But on a day like today, when you're only moving 6 or 7 fish, it's tougher. You know, it is tougher. And to be honest, yeah, you can get worse days than that. So,
welcome to the salmon angler's world.
Yeah.
Well, look, tune in the next few weeks. We'll do an episode of looking back on the trout season, another one also looking back on the salmon season, hear how 2022 went. But let's go back to Peter Driver. And Peter explained to us about his winning the National Rivers title.
Yeah, so it was held there 2 weeks ago on the Avonmore River up in County Wicklow. Rathdrum Trout Anglers hosted it again. I think it was their third or fourth time hosting the National Championships up there, the Taffy National Championships, interprovincial. And yeah, just everything went well on the day and a bit of practice beforehand and got the draw and got the fish to the net. And yeah, it just turned out at the end, I just got over the line. Nice to get it. They don't come along that often. We fished them for many years. It was 10 years since I won the last one in Kenturk. And yeah, they don't come along that often. So nice to get one, and especially nice to get one on home water.
You know, you knew the river well, you knew the stretch as well.
Yeah, I grew up on that river. I spent the entire childhood on that river learning the craft of fly fishing. Every summer, every weekend, I could get onto it. Spent my whole childhood growing up that river. So I know it well. Very difficult river to fish. Anyone that's fished it before, Tom, I think you've been on it too. One time we were getting ready for Sweden, but a very difficult river, very challenging. But if you do your homework well, get things you know, get your systems and your processes set up well, and attack it with positivity and not negativity. And after you have more, can sort of eat you up a bit if you start dropping the head at all. There is fish there to be got. There is definitely fish there to be got.
Well, you said that there's no guarantee, because it's your home water, that you're guaranteed success.
Do you know what, Tom? That's a great point. Yep. Because sometimes I see that as a disadvantage. An awful lot of people say, oh, it's your home river. He's going nowhere. But I already have preconceptions of all that water. Where if I drew a beat that I had no preconceptions about, and I walk in and I see a lovely streamy piece of water, well, then I straight away think, this looks fishy to me. There has to be fish here, whether there's fish or not. And I'll fish it with that intention that there's fish here. But when you draw a piece of water that you know as well as I know the Avonmore, and if you had bad experiences with that piece over a 10-year period or your lifetime fishing that piece of water, you straight away have preconceptions that I didn't get to draw. You know, I didn't get to draw before I
even get to the river. Yeah.
Because the question I was going to ask Peter, I was actually going to ask the flip of it was, you know, being a home water, you know, does it have the advantages and benefits? But it's a bit like kind of what you're talking about, confirmation bias. Isn't that what they call it? So, you know, if you're using that stretch and you come with a kind of a mindset going, oh, this, whereas if you come out of totally clean, you're just reading it very objectively, and that's the way it should
be. Absolutely. And it's often the case when I'm preparing for a competition on a piece of river that I might know quite as well, or it could be down in Cork, or it could be up the north, or wherever it is for whatever competition. I'll do very little practice on the competition water. So I don't have those preconceptions of what the river is going to be like, but I practice on very similar water on another piece of river somewhere else, you know? So at least when you arrive to your beat, you know, there's nothing there from 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago or 2 years ago saying, oh, I was here a couple of months ago and I didn't get any throat off that beat. That's not a great draw. You're straight away into the negative.
Put it very simply. You don't want your head to get messed up.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely
not. And that can play off of games when it comes to fly fishing, especially in tight rivers like the Avonmore. You know, moments of error there, only microseconds of error or microseconds of timing, you're going to be stuck in a tree, you're going to slip and fall into the river. And you know, they're all things that can really upset your whole game plan and upset your momentum if you get going tall or dropping a fish or whatever for, you know, these moments. So you need clear focus and you don't need your head messed up, as Tom said.
No.
Just tell us, Peter, how for the uninitiated, what's the format of it? How does it work in terms of the National Rivers competition?
So basically, it all starts, it's an interprovincial for starters. So there's four teams competing on a team basis. Leinster, Munster, Ulster, and Connacht are entitled to send 20 anglers per province to fish in the interprovincial. So there would be a Leinster finals, there'd be a Munster finals, so on in the earlier on in the season. The top 20 competitors from each championships, if there is 20 competitors, will go forward and fish the national championships. When you arrive, then you're fishing as part of a team and also as an individual. Two events and 1 day. And it's scored then on Fipsmoose rules. So you will have 2 3-hour sessions. It will be open draw. So you'll pick your morning session and there'll be a rotation draw, which will choose your afternoon session for you. You'll be group A or group B, depending on your draw. And you will compete against the people in that group. You're not competing against everybody, but you're competing against. So if I'm in group A, you know, I'm competing against the people in group A. If I win group A morning session, I get 1 place point. If I win group B or group A evening session, I also collect 1 place point, leaving me on 2 place points for the overall tournament. The person with the lowest amount of place points wins the tournament, basically. If it's a draw, it goes to the amount of fish.
Is it, you say in terms of winning, is it based on size of fish, total amount of fish? How is that calculated?
So the main figure would be place points. How would you determine who comes where is your fish measurements. So a 20-centimeter fish qualifies to be on the scorecard. Now in Rathdrum, because of the level of difficulty in the river and the time of year, we drop the size limit to 18 centimeters to the tip of the tail. So once it crosses 18 centimeters, it goes onto the scorecard. You're then calculated, there's a formula there, Fipsmoose formula that calculates the points for you. You get 100 points per fish and 20 points per centimeter of fish. And that gives you overall fish points. That will then determine your placing in that session as regards how many fish points you get. Not necessarily the amount of fish.
That formula actually rewards you for catching a bigger fish, basically.
Does it to a certain extent, but...
Whereas if it was just on normal length, let's say, you know, if it was just... This is the whole idea behind that, because if you caught 3 18-centimeter fish, but one guy caught... 1 18-centimeter fish and a 30-centimeter fish,
he would
if it was just on length,
yes,
the 3 18s would beat the other guy. Sorry, if it was 25. Do you know what I mean? But because of the formula that they put in, you do get a certain advantage for catching bigger
you
fish.
Get a reward not, for catching yeah. a bigger fish.
So it's not just numbers, basically.
But is it, yeah, no. like there's a weighting to if yeah. in those numbers. Yeah. So it's trying to get the balance of both, really.
Trying to get a good balance, absolutely. You know, on the morning session, myself and David Donovan both had 13 fish, and Dave came up to me in the car park and said, "How big were yours? You know, how did you get any 25s? I only had 25s. Did you get a 26? You know, that 1 centimeter of fish could be the difference between, and then lucky enough, it worked in my favor. You know, I got a couple of centimeters more than Dave did. Two or three of my fish were above 25 centimeters, where Dave never broke the 25 centimeter mark. So that got me over the line and won the morning session in Rathdrum on that.
And that left Dave on 2 points. Sorry, that left Dave.
That left Dave then on 2 place points in second place, and me on 1 place point going into the afternoon. Yeah.
And sorry, just one question. In terms of the measurement of that, who monitors, who measures it? Like, where does
so we all have our own controllers. So part of the tournament, we have to bring controllers with us, and you're then paired up against another competitor's controller. So I had a Munster guy with me, and he would then marshal you for the day, for the entire day, on all aspects of the tournament, not just measuring the fish, but leader lengths, barbless hooks. Fish welfare was a very big thing for us in this competition because of the drought, the temperatures that were there. You know, we really emphasized that all controllers were well educated on the morning of the competition to be aware of fish welfare, and the fish were being kept in the water while the angler was making his way back across the river, or if he'd come across stones, that, you know, every effort was made for fish welfare. So the controller has several jobs to do on the day, but to measure the fish. So we bring back the fish to controller, he measures it in a chute purposely made for it. And then he releases the fish and records on a scorecard if it makes the size.
Tom, have you ever done river competition fishing? Obviously, you've done it for
a while. I have, actually. Yeah, I have. Yeah. And I was telling Peter there, the first time I ever fished a river competition was when I fished for Ireland with Peter on our first ever, both of his our first caps in Sweden in the World Championship in 2001. And I actually now I qualified off the lakes. The first ever river competition I actually fished was my first river section at that competition. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm confused.
Yes. I'll try and put it really quickly. Yeah, well, how they do with a lot of the teams in the World Championship, they would pull a certain amount of the team from the Lake Championship and a certain amount of team from the Rivers Championship, thereby having a, let's say, a 50-50 mix, just really simplifying it. And they go out to a lot of world championships and European championships would have both lake and river sections.
Okay.
That's how it's so. But I since went on to, I did qualify for a couple of taffy teams off the National River Championships. So, but that was after I'd done my first ever.
After the experience.
Do a lot, most countries have separate like river and lake kind of competitions.
There is different qualification systems throughout the world. Different countries have different structures.
Yeah.
Some have super leagues. Some have a points-based system throughout the year, depending on competitions or where they finish in a certain amount of competitions. Some are handpicked. I think Ireland's it has a lot for it and it has a lot against it. It's very, what would you say, near almost diplomatic in a way. Everyone gets an opportunity to have a crack at an Irish cap. Which is important, you know. I think it's there's an awful lot for us, say, for and against. There are people say, well, we're not getting the consistency on the team, so we're not getting up in the you know, up higher rankings and stuff like that. But yeah, just back to what Tom said, he had never fished a river until he got to the World Championships. You know, when I qualified for that same team, I caught one fish in an All-Ireland final, and I was nearly going to mention that later on, but decided to go on the back burner now. But one fish in an All-Ireland, and I made that team.
Yeah.
One single fish in a tie, and I made that team. So I got my opportunity, even though I was very inexperienced at the time and very young, but I still got my opportunity to get my cap at that time. And, you know, so the way the system does work, some can argue that it's unfair, some can argue that it's actually, you know, it's a great opportunity. Everybody gets a fair crack at the whip.
It's democratic.
If things go right for them on the day, they can
have it. Yeah, it's very democratic, yeah. And, yeah. like, to be honest, you could spend a lot of time on bar stools arguing the pros and cons, seriously,
absolutely,
about the way about which team selection you would use. As Peter says, there's pros and cons to any method you have, but you have to say about the current one for the world and Europeans, it is very democratic,
and everyone gets a fair crack at it. Yeah. You get your luck on the day, and you make the team, whether you fish lakes or you fish rivers. If you earn your spot on the national team, you have every right to take it up and go and fish for your country. A great honor, probably one of the greatest honors I've ever had in fly fishing, was wearing the green jacket, and so.
Tom, actually, just on the Sweden thing, was it very daunting, very nerve-wracking?
Oh, like, God, yeah. Yeah, and funny, just talking about waiting there, I actually remember when I caught my fish on that, caught a grayling. And then when I was playing the grayling, because you got to remember, I'd only ever caught my first grayling 2 weeks before that when we went over to Wales.
That's right, yeah.
Very well done. Joe Trill organized for the team to split up. When we went over to the Welsh D, the fish were grayling. Because grayling were going to be big on this, and none of us had caught grayling before. And I was playing this grayling, I was nymphing, and I played this grayling, and then I thought it was a perch, right? I don't know, I'm not going to bust a perch. And the next day I got it in. Well, to get out of the lie, I had hopped on stones. And then when I went to go back to the controller, I couldn't see the stones for the sun. Oh, my God, I'm going to get washed away.
Anyway, there were big rivers there too, Tom.
Yeah, there were. They were huge.
The Vindelavan. The Vindelavan was that big river. What a river.
Yeah, oh, it was something else. But it was, what you say, when I looked out and I saw it, like, I mean, for you, Peter, you know how to read a river, right? And like, I'd be basically reading lakes, right? That's my forte. Mm. God, I looked out, like, to be honest, daunting is kind of an understatement now, to be honest.
Fish anyway.
Yeah, I did actually. I tell you, when I got that first grayling, I tell you the feeling I had going back out fishing, because it was only about it was an hour and a half into the session, and I was going, oh no, I'm gonna blank. And they're only 3 hour sessions, which is like Peter is saying, it's different. And I'm from a background of fishing lake competitions with 8 or 9 hours. You know, it's everything is so different. And like and you might tell us a bit about the way it is now, Peter. I mean, it's so, we were discussing this before, the way the 3 hour sessions are now, like you have to be young and fit.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. 100%.
You're not ambling around and looking at things, like you are rushing back to the controller.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's physically demanding. I know for at least 4 or 5 days after the Avamore, I was black and blue. I was knackered. I wasn't able to wag. And, you know, there's a good crop of young anglers coming through right now in Ireland. Robert Hackett there, Sean Dempsey, Kieran Riley. These are top class, really high end competition anglers, fit young men in their 20s, you know. Yeah. And I remember halfway through the second session on the Avonmore thinking, geez, like, you know, you're really feeling it now and you've got to push even harder to try to get over the line here. And all I could think about was these young lads like goats down the river from me, hopping from rock to rock, you know, and getting through the water. But it can be very physically demanding, absolutely.
What about the mental side of it? Because my impression of it is, you know, you've seen the lads in the river and it's just total concentration for those 3 hours. You're just not letting up. You're just, you know, all the way through. Like physically it must be very, very draining there.
It can, absolutely can, but it all depends on your mindset. Tom touched on earlier about, you know, not letting things get into your head, not getting your head messed up. It's about having good, you know, clear plan, clear focus of what you want to get through in that session or what your setups are. You know, I break every now and then into systems and processes. I'd have all that lined up in my head. It changes. It can possibly change at any second, but you try and have some kind of a structure or a plan in your head and execute that as best you can, especially in the first half an hour to set yourself. And then just, you know, you go through the motions. And after that, you push yourself as hard as you can, depending on the situation, depending on the river you're fishing, the beach you've got, the numbers that you need to get through that, the water that's in front of you. Obviously, some water will be shallow, some waters will be very deep, some waters will be quite heavy currents, you know, and you'll have to take every one of those challenges then as you see fit, as it move towards it, like, you know.
And is any method allowable? But, like, would most people be nymphing? Like, is that?
Majority of people would be nymphing. Dry fly, dry dropper, depends on time of the year. If there's rising fish, you'd take them on the dry. Wet flies can be very good, depending on the size of the beats, the cover water, streamers. You'll do whatever it takes to get the fish out.
I was asked you this before we discussed with Peter. Like, for example, how many rods would you have on a session made up? How many would you bring?
Well, we're only allowed three in Taffy, in the Trout Anglers Federations. In the Leinsters and the All Irelands, only three.
In the World Championships?
As many as I can carry on a plane.
So how many is the most you've carried at a World Championships or any of the international
competitions? Probably I've had up to 8, I'd say, at any one time set up on the bank of a river, depending. Yeah. And then probably I think the time I set up the eight rods, I got a lend of a couple of rods off a guy to make eight. And I think I had seven of them set up identical.
Identical?
Identical, seven identical. That's how important time was going to be for that session.
So basically, yeah. If you got a tangle, lost a fly or everything.
Just throw the rod in the river. I wouldn't even throw it on the bank. I just throw it in the river or throw it wherever it needs to go and get the second rod.
Is that because you're a tackle dealer? Oops, sorry.
I wasn't back then. But I came back and sold all the rods after that disaster with that company business. But no, it depends, you know. And then sometimes I've been in championships or big sessions, and one rod has got me the whole way through. You know, and when you crack off, you got to weigh up all decisions. This is the thing. You got to make these split-second decisions. And these split-second decisions will will often be the winning or the losing of a session. And Rathdrum, for example, coming into the final minutes of session, I'm a firm believer that, or I've always practiced that, even if there's only 2 or 3 minutes to go, if I think I have enough time to reset my cast, tie on clean leader, put on 2 clean nymphs, and throw 3 or 4 effective casts rather than sellotaping something together to get those last 2 minutes and not being effective, those 3 or 4 effective casts are far more beneficial to me than spending the last 2 minutes just going through the motions for no reason at all.
But that's been in control, and that's controlling, and that's actually thinking.
Absolutely.
And that's actually deciding beforehand rather than going around. And by doing that, you will more often than not reap some benefit rather than going around and flailing the water. Yeah.
But in Rathdrum, I cracked off I was told 2 minutes. I had 2 minutes to go, and I weighed it up in my mind for a microsecond. Do I reset? How long will it take me to reset? I knew it would take me about a minute, possibly a minute, 10 seconds to reset. That would have given me 50 seconds to try and I was only on 12 at that stage, so I needed another fish to win the session. And I weighed it up and I looked at the water, like all happened within a flash of a blink of an eye. I looked at the water, looked at the situation I was in at the top of here. I didn't even think, just stuck on another 3.5 mil bead and just went single nymph into one tiny pocket that I just had a good feeling there was a fish there. And lo and behold, I took a fish, literally the second your man. At the same moment he shouted time, I struck. And the fish counted.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you make those decisions. Now I could have made another decision to reset. So there's all these little micro decisions you make in a session that can go against you or go for you at any time. You can never predict. But I can tell you another 10 stories of where I've made the wrong decisions on other sessions, and they have actually cost me the competition or cost me the session because I made the wrong decision at the moment.
And I suppose as well, like, you know, you mentioned lads who are, you know, maybe physically fitter in their 20s, but what you've got is experience, the benefit of experience.
Well, absolutely, yeah, that helps. That's always a good thing. It slows you down a little bit. It makes you just think about things a little bit more rational kind of in a way, rather than just rushing into a decision or doing something silly. You know, it does settle you down a little bit. The age thing.
Well, you know, with age comes wisdom, so we're told. But anyway.
we got much of that yet, Tambo. I'm working on it.
But listen, what you're looking at, different rivers, then what you're thinking is, let's say rivers where there's a lot of fish in it, it's going to suit the more physical, more athletic, and the younger guys. Would that be right?
Yeah, depending on the river, depending on the size of the river, depending on how much physicality is needed to fish that river. If you're fishing heavy, deep water all day long and wading through it, if the fish are spread out through it, you know, that 3 hour session there, you know, if you've crossed that river 20, 30 times in 3 hours, you know, physically the man, that's going to wear you down very quickly. Like, especially if you need to recover within a 2 hour period to get ready for another one coming up in the afternoon. You know, that can work. Yeah, that certainly can, you know, the physicality, the young age. Like, you look at all the big teams out there, the French, the Spanish, you know, even the Polish now, they're coming back a little bit strong at the moment. The Americans, you know, they're not just fishermen, they're athletes. Them boys are on them teams, they are athletes, they are fit, you know, they're absolutely training for these championships. You know, they're a different breed altogether. Like,
can I ask you actually, like, traditionally kind of like, wasn't it the French and the Czechs and that they would have dominated?
Poland would have dominated first. The Polish were the first real guys to, you know, really, they invented nymphing. So Polish bugging was what they invented back in the 90s or the 80s, I think it was. And, you know, and then it was taken on by other countries and other schools of nymphing was developed in France and Spanish and blah, blah, blah. But the Poles would have been very strong for a long time and still are always up there knocking around the top table. The French would be probably the most dominant. The French and the Spanish would be the two most dominant teams in the last two decades.
Why is that, actually?
And the Czechs. Sorry, Czechs. The Czechs would be those top three teams. It's a whole mix of reasons, really, Dira. You know, it's teamwork. It's teamwork. It's commitment. It's commitment from their federations towards their teams. They're supported very well. You know, it's practice. It's having the opportunities to fish. Like, you could name, say, the top most successful five anglers or 10 anglers in Ireland, river and lake. If they had been born in Spain or Czech Republic or France, would they have gold medals hanging around their neck by now? Absolutely. Because they would have had opportunities as well. You know, again, this is going back to the conversation we had before about the qualification system in Ireland. This is one of the cons. You know, these guys get to fish Worlds and Europeans year in, year out, year in, year out for 10 years, possibly even some of them for 20 years. Now, you're not always going to get the luck of the draw, but you're going to get it once, at least every couple of years. You know, in those 10-year periods, you're going to get the luck of the draw, and then you're going to get medals. But you have five men getting the luck of the draw, or even three of those guys getting the luck of the draw. That's enough to get you into the medals. They've got the experience of fishing these championships. They're fishing them so often. It's like us just going to a Leinster championships. You know, we're so used to them.
Yeah, the pros and the cons of the democracy.
You know, it weighs the whole thing up. But it's teamwork. One thing that I find very inspiring inspirational when I go to those competitions, I see those big teams and the teamwork, you know, the etiquette that's within the team. How do you back each other? How do you fish for each other? You know, out in the mornings on the bus, you know, you won't see one of the Spanish guys lying in the bed because he's not getting on the bus for another 2 hours and the other four Spanish lads getting on the early buses. Everyone's in the car park. You know, everyone's supporting each other and really pushing each other on. You know, the amount of work they put into their team and teamwork and companion, or, you know, the whole way they work as a unit is inspiring at times.
With the internet and YouTube and the sharing of information, and, you know, you can find out new methods much more quickly nowadays than you would have 20 years ago. Is the gap then narrowing? From, like, you know, you mentioned how Poland developed an infing and then it kind of developed further in kind of, you know, Czech and France and other Spanish or other European countries. But is that kind of gap of information now narrowing that everybody has access to the same information? Absolutely. Everybody has access to the same methods now. There's nothing really truly innovative or new.
No. And we've often, myself and a few friends that compete a lot together, we've often talked about, you know, is there anything ever going to be new invented again for let's say river anyway, for river competition fishing? You know, the jig hooks have been invented. You know, barbless hooks have been invented. You know, everything has been invented. Euro nymphing has been developed along the way over generations or decades, should I say. You know, is there ever going to be another major, you know, thing? Possibly a fly pattern or piece of fly material will be as extreme as it ever becomes. But technically, across the whole, you know, world championships or European championships, the field of anglers are there. There's very little in difference between them, really. You know, technically wise, everyone's very technically sound. We all have the equipment. As you say, we all have the access to the knowledge. There's a little bit of difference there between the hunter, maybe, and the angler. You know, you can buy all the gear, read all the books, get the lessons and all that. But you've got to have something inside you too. There's an ingredient that has to come from you, and that's that raw desire, that hunter, you know, that to get you that extra couple of fish, to get you that, to make you cross that river without even thinking about it, you know, to make you go that little bit harder. And that's something that's born within you possibly, or you've got to find within yourself. And some competitors don't necessarily find that in time for tournaments or don't really get that whole concept that it's got to be something from you too. But I think in relation to technical abilities, Ireland is as good as any other team in the world, same as any other team is technically wise. But bringing all those factors together and everything else and the consistency, you know, consistency there as well, support from teammates, all these little factors, all these little things, you know, it's the details we miss out on, not necessarily. And we focus maybe too much on the bigger picture rather than looking at the small details that other teams tend to get right. And we might.
Would you feel like, and it's a thing I know was discussed before, but when we saw all those rivers and we think, like, we have no real fast rivers in Ireland. Do you remember we went to we actually fished the Weir in Galway? Do you remember that?
That's right, yeah.
The session, we were let into the Weir. And that's one of the few places of, like, and there was a 100-meter stretch of it. And, like, the river in Sweden was like that for about miles and miles and miles. But do you think it's a drawback that we don't have a huge amount of those big, fast rivers in Ireland?
I wouldn't say necessarily a massive drawback. not as big as the drawback, Tom, that we, the fact that you, the point you hit on there was that Spain doesn't have good fishing. France have very tough fishing. Czech Republic, it's stock fishing. It's not great fishing. We are spoiled here for choice. That's our problem. You can go down to the Nore on an optimal day and you can get 40 or 60 fish an hour on nymph in there. And sure, if you drop 20, what the hell with it? Sure, I'm going to get another 20 in the next. And we have Miles River. So a guy starts in the river and he fishes for 4 miles that way and he gets 20, 30 fish. He's brilliant. You know, he's had a great day and more luck to him. I've done it myself. I do it every day I go out. You know, you travel water and you keep fishing. If you miss one, you miss one. When you go to Spain to fish these rivers, even for pleasure fishing, you miss one fish, that's pretty much you done for the day. They can't afford to miss fish because they're only going to meet one anyway. You know, they can't afford to drop a fish because it's probably the only trout they're going to get for the day in some of these rivers. You know, and maybe what we don't do enough of is practicing on the tougher rivers we have here in Ireland. We're nearly spoiled. It just kind of enforces our, you know, kind of, what would you say, complacency in our fishing, you know, because, you know, we're getting 20, 30 fish. They're great numbers, but like we're probably missing 10 or 15 to get those 20 fish, and that's not good.
Good complaint to have.
Absolutely.
Just not if you want to win Worlds.
Not if you want to be, looking to win a Worlds. Is there an Irish team ever capable of, I please to God, or I hope to God one day I get to see it. I'd love to see an Irish team on a podium in the Worlds. You know, they've done very well in Masters, Five Nations, all these other tournaments. Even in open tournaments, the Irish teams have held their own, you know, and we've proven to the world that we can compete with the best of them. We're as good as anyone. You just love to see it all come together for one World Championships. I really would. Yeah. Regardless of who's on the team, you know, it's worth them 100%. But you love once just to, you know, it'd be amazing.
It would be nice, wouldn't it?
When is the next Worlds and where?
The next Worlds are coming up now in a couple of weeks' time in Spain. There's a good, strong team going there. Kieran Riley, Sean Dempsey are going there. Declan
the Conley, young lads you mentioned.
Sean Buckley, a couple of young lads going there. And so this is the first real big, back to the whole big show of World Phipps Mush in Spain. So that's coming up in a couple of weeks. So really looking forward to seeing the guys get on to that. Hopefully they get a run at.
Moving away from competitions, Peter, how has the season been for you? We're coming up to the last few weeks now.
It's amazing. It's unbelievable. Like, where did that year go?
Yeah, are you looking forward to the close season or are you kind of, would you miss it?
Come September, I'm always looking forward to be finishing up. I actually dusted off my beach gear there yesterday. I'll do a bit of beach fishing now for the off months. I do a bit of stocky fishing and a bit of grayling fishing, but I'll go and I'll spend some time on the beach. It's just mindless fishing. It's come September. I'm it's been a long season. And you'd be kind of looking forward to winding down a bit on the trout and doing some other stuff, you know. It becomes fairly monotonous, as Tom would know, every day of the week, being on the rivers, constantly, not even that, just thinking about it nonstop, you know, when you're in the game, you're thinking about it, you're talking about it, your whole world is revolved around fly fishing and fly fishing the rivers or lakes. So, it's a little bit of a break, kind of coming into the winter months.
Do you get any much pleasure fishing done during the season?
Not this year, no, not a lot. Got a nice day with Tom on the duck fly, a couple of days there on the May fly. They were probably my three most fullest days, actually pleasure fly fishing. Went to Iceland for a few sea trout. That worked out to be quite nice. A couple of days out there, tiring trip, but it was worth it. But on the river here at home, I'd say I didn't get on the river at home on my own 5 times.
Wow.
Here in the north, and I'm living 130 yards from it, 150 yards from it. You know, it's
the weather probably played against you there as well. We lost massive,
We lost the whole front end of the season with wind. Yeah. And cold, you know, you were out fishing, but like it was very difficult fishing. There was no consistency in fish behavior. There was no consistency in fly hatches. It was just, again, we saw a trend in the meantime. We spoke about this before. There's a trend growing there of this northeasterly wind coming in April, May, just wiping the whole start of the real, which is probably the best time of the year to be on the rivers, April, May. You know, trout's metabolism is at its peak. They're moving on to hatches. They're moving into those summer lies. They're spreading out a bit. And then you get this northeasterly breeze and it just, everything gets knocked in the head. I call it lifeless air. You know, just nothing can survive in it. Like, there's no life in the air.
You guys seen that as a relatively new phenomenon in the last few years? Phenomenon's the wrong word. New trend in the last few years?
Yeah, I definitely have noticed it more. Yeah, I have to say, like, in the last 5 or 6 years, we've had 2 or 3 Aprils, probably. I didn't check my diary, but I do keep it in mind. Definitely had 2, not 3. Of an April going into May of that, just as Peter
and
says,
it pushes the whole season out.
Lifeless
pushes the whole season out and puts the trout off, and And they very, you know, it takes them a while then to get back into where they should be seasonal wise. And then for the last two summers, we've seen massive drought come in straight after it and go to 3 or 4 months of no water. So, you know, for the last 4 to 5 weeks here on the rivers, we just stopped fishing just because
have you been out fishing on the river?
No, I haven't been out in Orne in ages because of low water and water temperature is too high. The fish are too stressed. The water, you know, algae blooms in the bed of the river and stuff like that. It's just, no. It's okay on, say, mountain streams like the Avamore. Those fish, you know, it's cold water river. No weed growth in them, no algae, you know, kind of the temperature. There's deep, massive deep holes there that keep the water temperature level and a lot of underground springs and stuff. But unlike some of the, say, the midland rivers, the Nore and stuff like that, it's like a boiling pot because their fish are so exposed, the water is so shallow in that kind of climate that fish become very, very stressed. And if you're catching them and returning them, there's a good chance they're not going to return safely.
What about, Peter, for the last few weeks of the season? Do you think, will it be fishable again?
Well, we've a bit of right drop of water coming through now at the moment. So we were lucky enough there to get a good shot of rain 2 days ago. And we got another big blast of it today. So the river's quite high at the moment. If that settles in time, we could see it the last week of the season possibly being quite good, or last 10 days, 2 weeks maybe, of potentially getting some fish. Yeah.
Any tips for people in terms of kind of September fishing, how they should approach it or what they should be doing?
September fishing, it changes an awful lot in September. You know, trout start to really think about the migration. It's the hours of the daylight that I think that trout go by. Once the daylight starts closing in a little bit faster, trout start and all this, it's like autumn is coming. You know, water temperature is always going to be around the same anyway. It's not going to drop overnight. Like, so it's the daylight hours that kind of, for me, I think is a big signal for the trout to start changing behavior. So in September, I'd be, you know, looking for pods of fish more so than searching out summer lies for lots of single fish. You know, they'll start to pod up a bit. They'll drop back out of those highly oxidated, the runs. they'll drop back out of those runs and they'll sit back in more slacker water, start reserving fat levels, building up their fat levels, getting ready for a long winter. You know, you got to source out. And the more we get into end of September, you know, I'll be doing an awful lot more wet fly fishing, not necessarily just to catch fish, but to find those pockets an awful lot quicker, where if I'm nymphing up to a large piece of water, that's going to take me an awful lot longer than if I'm swinging wets over that piece of water. I can cover an awful lot of water in 15 to 20 minutes and identify, right, there could be a pocket there, there could be a pocket there, and then come back and target them and work it. Dries or dry dropper or nymphing.
That's really interesting about the pods, because that happens on the lake too.
Yeah, you got to find those pods.
Yeah, they group up. But I didn't know that they did that on the rivers, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. No, they do, Tom, and I've seen, and we've been at it for years. You know, we'll always, you know, wet flies is something we'd never write off. You know, talk about modern techniques and all that, like spider fishing and wet fly fishing in the back end of September is probably some of the best way to catch trout, you know. But definitely to find those fish, because you can cover an awful lot of water very quickly to identify where there potentially could be a pod of fish, and then, you know, go back and target them on dry fly or dry dropper, or, you know, or stay on them with the wets. You know, stay on them. If you're picking off a few with the wets, why not stay on them and keep picking them after? So, yeah, you're looking for those kind of things. I'd also be very in tune kind of to give them a feed in September. I always like going a little bit bigger with my flies in September, because they are in that state where, you know, winter's coming, and that they want to reserves. And that's one thing I did in the Avonmore was, you know, in that low river and the hot weather, an awful lot of people went down to 2 mil, 2.5 mil. I did the opposite. I went up to size 14 hooks and I put on 3.5 mil beads and I fished two massive nymphs the whole session in the shallows. And just give them something to feed, give them something to eat.
Interesting. Very interesting. Time of day, would you recommend?
Daytime fishing now, evening rises are gone. You're looking at midday rises, you know, best time. It depends on, if you want to be watching the fly hatches, this time of the year we can see a return if we get the weather like we had today, a bit squally, wet, drops, maybe the air temperature want to drop a little bit more. But you can see a nice little hatch of iron blues maybe coming back on late September. You know, you get some olives coming back out. You'll still get a few caddis around. So there's an abundance of fluid or food for fish at the end of September, which can make it very interesting fishing. But daytime fishing now, really, you know, you're looking at, you know, midday rises possibly coming on. They could get a bit more sporadic as we get out right to the end of the season. But you're looking anything from, say, depending on the temperature, 12 to 3 o'clock, best time probably.
One of the things, streamers, would streamer be more successful in September?
Not being a streamer expert, but yeah, I do fish them in the heavy water. If you get the heavy water like we have now, if you were down there now on the streamers, there today or tomorrow, yeah, you'd have a great chance at some fishing along the marsh, right, pushing out of the way and stuff like that. But streamer fishing can be quite effective, yeah, once if there's heavy water.
So are they recognizable lies where those pods are, you know, year in, year out? Or, you know what I mean? So what I suppose what I'm trying to say is, if you find where a pod stacks up in September, is it going to be there the following September? Obviously based maybe on Riverhead or whatever, but is the lie the same? Like,
yeah, good question. I think they'll be in the area. Okay. I have a firm belief that trout are very territorial, you know, and when I'm kind of coaching on nymphing techniques and stuff like that, you know, I speak an awful lot about fish behavior and fish management. And I believe on the likes of the River Nore, fish will have a kind of territory of maybe 20 yards, circumference of 20 yards. And you can do whatever you want inside that territory, and they will not leave that territory. They will remain there. They have what I would identify as a protective lie and a predominant lie. Now, I think as we come out to back end of the season, that becomes a little blurred because they change their lies from their summer lies back into their autumn lies, and they'd have different spring lies. I think they'd be in the same area, Daira, not necessarily behind the same rock, but I think there is common places within a particular stretch of water that they're looking for where it's slacker, but, you know, they're just off the gravy train. They still have they need that conveyor belt food this time of the year. So they're not going to sit into the main runs or, you know, where they're burning up energy levels and fat levels. They're going to sit off those a bit, back into more slacker water, feeding up, but they still need that conveyor belt of food coming to them the whole time to be eaten up. So they'll be in, they'll be in identifiable water, I think, commonly, more so than behind that Pacific, in that right there in that corner, you know. It depends, because if that gets filled up with silt or sand during the winter floods, or a rock moves and there's not that protection is no longer there for them, well, then they're not going to be there next season if the environment changes. But it'll be commonly the same type of water that they'll drop back into, really. Yeah.
That's a really interesting point, because that doesn't happen with the lakes, but you know, a river is constantly changing. Mm. I've been told that, you know, what you said about a rock moving, it could upset everything in a pool.
But one rock moves and the whole thing changes. Yeah.
We don't have that in a lake. You know, the point of the island is always going to be the point of the island.
Point of the island, yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
But we'd find definitely, yeah, you'd find them showing up in places where, you know, that are good to fish, the point of the island. That said, in the deeps, you could find them anywhere. You know, you can find them anywhere, and they are definitely moving. That's the only thing I find. All right, let's say at the point of island, you could find a pod of good fish. We'd normally get one good fish, right? But there's a couple of other fish have moved in together. But with the deeps,
is that all food related, Tom? Is that all food related?
The points of the island, places like that, definitely are. When they're out in the deeps like that, now, are they on Daphne, or are they actually just beginning to shoal to go to the rivers? I personally think there's an element of the latter in it, but I think they are beginning to shoal to go up in the river. Like I've been privileged to see some of the shoals in the Cernamona River here. I still have them on videos of shoals of fish in over 100 fish, right, in a show. I've taken videos of them, I have them. It's absolutely fantastic. And they're all showing together. They're working as one in a show. They're just there together. I firmly believe that there's an element of that out in the lake as well, where they're getting ready to move, and that they'll move up together. And that said, I've seen river in the earlier on where you get them the single fish moving together. And I've seen the river when it's been slack and just singles. But then there are times when, yeah, they're just there in one big show.
Interesting, very interesting. Peter, we mentioned that coming up to the end of the season and October, even though you're getting the beach casting rods out, you still can't help yourself. Back by popular demand, turn of the Saturday night fly tying. Yeah. Tell us more when people can expect it and what they can expect.
Yeah, we're back for another. We're excited to do another winter. Excited to do another winter of it. And how long I'll be able to keep going before I run out of patterns and information. But excited to do another season. And yeah, look, it's been great crack. The last two seasons, of course, the first one happened in COVID, and it was great for everybody, myself included. You know, and the feedback you got back off, it wasn't just out great information or great patterns or whatever it may be. It was that everyone felt that they were part of a community kind of nearly thing on Saturday night, where we all came together and just, you know, let off a little bit of steam, had a bottle of beer or a cup of tea or whatever was your fancy. And we all tried to advise, had a virtual conversation, basically, which we were all missing. You know, as anglers, we're very sociable creatures, us fishermen. And while we do practice the sport an awful lot on our own, but we do love coming together and having a natter about things. And you know, that was a kind of an opportunity for people to come on a Saturday night, you know, and it just grew from there. And yeah, then last season we did it and it went well. And again, the feedback was good. So once people are happy enough to follow it and watch it and take something from it, then I'm happy enough to facilitate that. So we're back again this season. We've added a few new little things now this year. So we've got a casting clinic coming on. We've got a couple of professional casters coming on that are going to be doing it. They're already made their videos and stuff like that. So they, you know, casting clinics on simple stuff that people can work on over the winter months if they wish. And to improve themselves for next year, we got a taxidermist coming on with us. He's made us 10 videos of feather care and feather harvesting, which is very interesting. Can't wait for that. Some of the stuff I've seen and some stuff I haven't. So he's, you know, we've over the summer months, we've collected animals off different places and we've froze them. And then when he's ready to make his video, we'll talk about the cock pheasant and how to harvest, what feathers are you looking for off that cock pheasant, how to treat the skin properly and safely, how to, you know, feather care, storage, all that kind of stuff, what chemicals are out there that are safe to use, how does this, whatever it may be. He's going to do some dyeing work with us as well. So that's really interesting. That's a new part coming in. Our usual then, our special guests, and I'll rustle up a couple of fly patterns between now and then to throw out there as well. So it's going to be, it's good. I'm looking forward to it now. I always look forward to those Saturday nights. They're a bit of crack. You know, they really are. I do get a great kick out.
When are they starting?
October the 8th, Tom. October the 8th will be the first one. That's kind of our first one. And what we'll do is just review the season. I have a couple of patterns there that worked well or discovered over the season. And we'll just tie a few those, a few intros into what the show is going to be for the next 20 episodes. And then tear away then every Saturday from then on.
Brilliant. And where can people, do they need to register in advance, or what's the URL?
No registration. And we put it up on Facebook Live. Unfortunately, where I live, our internet connection is quite weak. So I've been, over the last two summer months, trying to, you know, make it a little bit better, more accessible for more people. We can only stream to Facebook Live at one time. I've tried to do YouTube, Instagram and Facebook at the same time, but we don't have the strength here. So it goes on Facebook, on the Piscari Fly Facebook page. You log in there on a Saturday night and it's just there. Just click and watch away and it's free. And then I put it up. Then what I do is on Sunday morning, I put the video up, I record the video, and it goes up onto YouTube on the Sunday morning, because an awful lot of people go back and watch it and take the references or rewatch for particular patterns or, you know, tips or whatever I might be talking about. And we have a lot of special guests come on, so people like to watch some of that stuff twice to really get the benefit of it, you know, or three times. So we have a lot of followers that are not on Facebook. They watch it in on a Sunday morning.
Super. Well, we'll tune into that. Keep an eye out for that on a Saturday night. Yeah, exactly. Final question, Peter. I've given you advance notice now, so sometimes I've forgotten to do it and I've put guests on the spot. But as always, our last question is, what is your most memorable fish that you have caught? Not necessarily your biggest, but your most
memorable. Well, that's a good point, because people would often ask me, you know, what is your best fish? And I'd say, you know, what's your biggest fish? I wouldn't be able to tell you what my biggest fish is. Size has never been a big thing for me. You know, I think it's, but I can tell you about the 6-inch trout I caught at the Avonmore, or an 18-centimeter trout I caught at the Avonmore with the last cast. How valuable was that fish for me that morning? You know, fish, or the fish I caught in the toy, fish of a lifetime, changed my whole, you know, changed my, it pathed out my whole fishing career. That one fish in a toy, who would have thought it? You know, things like that. So, you know, there's loads of fish there that you could, you know, I was looking about, say, that one in Sweden, or the one to get to Sweden, the one, there was one in a competition again in Cork, myself and Dave Donovan, caught it literally in the first session, but it was the last cast, and I had to race maybe 50 yards to throw that cast, a full cast dry dropper, up into a corner where I knew there had to be one more fish, and made that cast while stumbling at the same time, and hooked that fish and took it to the net, all in a moment like of madness. But that fish won the session for us, and we kicked on to win 404, you know. So there's been a lot of fish, barracuda on the fly in Dominican Republic. I could write a book on fish. But there's one story, and it's very memorable, not just because it was a lovely trout, or the conditions we caught it in, or whatever it may be, but it was the time, it was the moment. And that's very important thing to for any people that are out there fishing. No, it's not just about the size of the fish or the catch or the technical ability to catch it, but, you know, it's where you are at the time. It's who you're with is very important too, you know. And I can't even remember the year. Back in 2004, 2005, I was going through a very changing time in my life, I suppose it would be the best way of describing it. And my dad had just had a triple bypass, And, you know, things were changing. The stars were aligning, but I wasn't aware at the time what where the stars were aligning me towards. Looking back now, I can see, oh, that's the way that happened. That's the way I'm going. At the time, it was very confusing and things like that. Things were up in the air and off like every aspect of my life. But anyway, Dad was starting to recover a bit and he wanted to go away, get the hell away for a few days. So I said, you know, this is June or July. It was July, I think it was at the time. And I said, look, let's go to the West. Let's go to the West. Dad loves the Corrib. And let's go to the West. Nice weather. He was strong enough to go. And we just go for 2 days, 3 days. And just chill out and get away from everything. And he agreed anyway. So we went home. We stayed in Cong. We fished the Corrib the first day. Got a suntan. Was about all we got. Flat cam. Not a trout to be seen. We were the only people on the whole Corrib, I'd say, sitting out there. But we sat out in the boat. And we had our tea and sandwiches. And we drank and turned off the phone. It was a lovely day. Stayed in Cong that night. Took a walk around the village. Got some dinner and went back. And we were on the mast the next day. Never fished mast before in my life. Nor Dad. And we were boating it as well. So got up the morning. And went out with mast. Flat cam. Not a riffle on it. Sun. 20 something degrees. Bright sunshine. There was a couple of other loony souls that went out that same day. I don't know where we actually went out of now. I couldn't even tell you, Tom. But we hired a boat from my dad anyway, but we didn't get. We're going up for a drive. We're going to drive around and see Loch Mask. And so fished away here and there. So Dad says, here, pull in there. That's a nice looking island. We'll have a cup of tea. So we pulled in, we got out the Kelly Kettle, made the tea and sat and had sandwiches and talked. And oh, here, come on. He says, we'll get up and go back in the boat. We'll go for another drive. So we might spot an outshoot somewhere, you know. So got into the boat, put the boat in reverse, start reversing back. Dad pushes out a little bit, got the oar, put it into the water, pushes out. Turn the engine on reverse, start reversing out and spun the boat around. At the same time, Dad said, oh, look, there's a little bit of a riffle over there. He said, looking in distance, you know, it was like a mirage on desert of water. You know, you see this little riffle, get over there quick. There's a wave. And so anyway, we start, put on the engine and start motoring away. And next thing, I said, geez, look behind you. He said, there's a trout behind you. And I said, what? He said, there's a trout rising behind you. Stop the engine quick. So I stopped and looked back, and lo and behold, there was rings of a trout right after rising. So I grabbed the rod, stripped the rod as fast as I could in panic to cover this fish. Covered the fish anyway, and a couple of pulls across it, nothing. And next thing, he came up again. Jeez, there he is again, Dad. Dad says, there he is again. And I stripped back in and covered the fish again, 2 yards to the right or 2 yards to the left, whatever it was, and tried it again. And next thing, the fish came up for a third time, and I looked at him and said, that's not right. What the hell is going on there? I said, that trout's not rising. Something's wrong. And next thing I said, I think he's floating on the surface. So Dad said, geez, drive over. So I drove the boat over anyway and pulled up alongside this lovely big three and a half pound brown trout. Beautiful big bar of gold. And here's your man floating up at the top of the lake with the mark of the propeller in the back of his head. Where we'd ran over him coming out of the lake. Ran over the trout and put the net under and put the trout into the bag. And that's, geez, that's the handiest trout we'll ever get. But now, yeah, we came back in off the lake. And this is true. I'm just telling the story, and you can put the story out. And my dad will back me up 100%. There's even a few men on mast that back it up for a new year. But we're coming back in off the lake anyway. And we pulled up at the shore. And, geez, we were delighted ourselves with our trout. And he wasn't going back, unfortunately. We would have tried to put him back. But he was dead as a duck. But anyway, arrived in, and the other lads were coming in off the lake. There was a couple of lads out for a drive. Dad didn't even see a trout. Dad took out this big proud trout, and anyway, proud as a bunch. And geez, what you get him on? I got him on the propeller fly. So we often meant to design a fly pattern and call it the propeller fly. But the boys couldn't believe, geez, what's that fly? Oh, that's a top secret pattern of us Wicklow boys and bad advice. Dan for ages in the car park. Such a crack we had. But you know what? What a memorable fish. It wasn't even just that it was a lovely trout, or there's a whole story about it. The fact I was there with my dad, you know, on that weekend, we had a lovely weekend that weekend. And that's what fishing's all about too. It's not just about the competitions or the medals. That stuff was all great. But for me, it's the memories, it's the stories we have, it's the companionship we have with our fellow anglers and things like that. So, you know, it leads us to great places at times, fly fishing. Whacking wonderful. But that was my most, you know, I debated about all week, what's my most memorable fish, what's the one story I'd have, not just that stands out from the rest, like they're all fabulous trout, like, but you know, one most memorable was that one, not just because of the trout, but or the story that we ran him over.
You'll have to tie that fly during the
I will, yeah. I'll have to come up with a propeller fly. Yeah, I've often thought about trying to come up with some kind of an idea and call it a propeller fly. Yeah,
there a pattern? There used to be patterns that have little spinning vanes at the front of it. I'm seeing it already.
They're like little bow ties. Do you salmon anglers use them quite a bit, actually? And I've seen them on trout flies, Tom, too, you know.
Yeah, telling you.
Little double spinner blades, and you just fit on in front of your bead or in front of a threaded head. and it will spin as you pull. And what it does actually, it creates air bubbles going out the back.
No, I'd never use it, of course.
Yeah, it's good when you're on the troll. It's good when you're on the troll and dragging.
Troll? What's that? Troll? I wouldn't know.
Peter, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
That's absolutely fantastic. Thanks very much for having me on. Great show, and love listening to the podcast. And keep up the good work, guys.
And likewise, we can't wait now for October to come along, and we'll just tune in.
Yeah, looking forward to having you on, Tom. Tom will be on with us at some stage.
So everywhere these days now, Peter, you can't get them, you know, away from the media now, like, you know.
So,
Peter, thanks for joining us.
Cheers. All right, Peter, guys, brilliant. Thanks. Take care of yourselves.
Our thanks to Peter Driver for joining us on the show, and don't forget to rate, review and follow the Ireland on the Fly podcast on Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Plus, you can keep up to date on IrelandOnTheFly.com as well as on Instagram, and myself and Tom will be back with another episode about the people and places of fly fishing in Ireland. Mayfly time is the pinnacle for most brown trout anglers, and we're pleased to announce our next Ireland on the Fly Masterclass is focusing on mayfly tactics with international angler, guide and renowned fly tyer Jackie Mann.
On Thursday the 25th of April at 8 p.m, Jackie will be discussing how to make the most of the conditions, the best flies and methods to use, as well as giving his tips and insights from a lifetime of experience.
So, to join us for this masterclass on Thursday, 25th of April, just go to www.irelandonthefly.com/masterclass. Tickets cost €10 and all attendees will get a copy of Jackie's notes as well as access to the recording of the webinar afterwards.
And stay tuned for our masterclasses throughout 2024, covering salmon, rivers, lochs, streamers, lures, dries, everything to make you a better salmon or trout fly angler, helping you to catch more this year and to learn from the best. For more information, email us on info@irelandonthefly.com.